The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. The BioRevolution Podcast, welcome. Are you all ready for a new episode? Hope so. Easy, are you?
I am.
Last time we thought about having like a wizard thing, our guests coming up from under the table. But we come back to this idea, maybe.
We talked about shorts before, right?
True, maybe true.
We can start with...
We can do that.
Yes.
Yeah. From Bench to Mic, Demystifying Science, our topic today. And we have a guest. And you do the kudos after, I guess, some quotes, as always.
Let's start with quotes, and then we'll introduce Chani. So I will start with reading a quote from Paul Nurse. I think even Sir Paul Nurse?
Could be.
Yeah. Nobel Prize winner, molecular biologist, who says, better understanding of the natural world not only enhances all of us as human beings, but can also be harnessed for the better good leading to improved health and quality of life. So, broad scope.
Yeah.
I brought one from Caroline Bertozzi, who just won the Nobel Prize in 2022 back then. And she says, your purpose as a scientist is not to achieve fame or money. That is not your purpose. Those might be side effects and good for you. That could be wonderful for you, but it is a side effect. It is not the main goal. The main goal is to make discoveries and give them to humanity. And those discoveries and that knowledge stays with humanity long after you're gone.
This is beautiful.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. I love it.
Like it.
Really good quote. Excellent. So Chandni, let me introduce you a little bit, and maybe some of our listeners and viewers will already know you from your podcast, Daily Dose of Honest Science, where you create beautiful videos with scientists often
as guests. Fits to the quote, by the way, right?
It fits to the quote, exactly. But you are also a bench scientist, so you actually bridge those two roles other than we do. So I only talk about science. I don't do science anymore for quite a long time. So you have, let's say, the best of both worlds, maybe sometimes also not the best. Sometimes
time-wise,
you also experience, experience the other parts. You are a postdoc at LMU.
Mm-hmm.
You're a podcast host. You're a proteomics enthusiast. That's another thing we share.
Yeah.
Let's dive into that, but not too deeply, not to alienate our audience with too deep mass spec talk.
I will make them convinced that proteomics is the best.
So very nice having you on the show.
Thank you very much for giving me the invitation, and I'm really happy. Came from Munich to Frankfurt.
Very nice. Very nice having you in person and not remote as so many times.
Yeah.
And it's really great. LMU, it's
yes.
Kind of a magic place. I think LMU is, together with TUM, universities in Munich, that have the most excellent clusters in Germany, as I believe.
Yes. And
is it in the air or in the water?
I guess it's Bavaria. I don't know. The beautiful landscape of Bavaria. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But,
possible. Possible.
Yeah. Yes. Because we have the mountains. We have Zugspitze. So
around the corner. It's
right.
So. True. Science communication. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that Easy has been into for a long, long time now. And I, as a spectator, so to speak, from the sidelines as a journalist and not being a scientist, and going to conferences and talking to scientists, I again and time again come across people who are not either willing or capable of shaping their message in portions that are, let me frame it, like digestible for the broader public. And I believe we're in a space and time right now, also with the geopolitics surrounding us, where we urgently need exactly this.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we solve this?
I guess we can. It just needs us scientists, but also science communicators who have said that they want to do things differently, that we sit together and make this possible. And I think it's very important that we scientists also go out. As you said now and mentioned that some scientists feel a bit, you know, overwhelmed by this.
Okay.
And I think the problem is everyone thinks if you're doing science communication, it must be a video format. But science communication can also be a blog. Right?
Yeah, written.
You can
write
things.
Sure.
You don't have to stand like me in front of a mic and talk and being filmed. And some of the scientists, I feel like they don't want to break out of their bubble. That's also a bit kind of the problematic point here, and kind of don't want to engage with the thoughts of the general public. You know, like if you work in CRISPR, for instance, sometimes people are kind of scared because they only know like it's a gene scissor. So if they cut out genes that I actually need, what happens then to me? You know, if you communicate it in such a way that they understand, well, we are not cutting out a gene that you necessarily need. It's just fixing something that is wrong in your body, which, you know, many clinical trials are coming up now.
Right.
Then this fear gets a bit less. And also like the corona crisis, I think we made a big mistake not communicating much and or in the wrong way, like all the experts back then was not really nicely done, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree that there is a challenge in communicating science in a way. I think there are two hurdles. One thing, it's very complex, so you need to communicate it somehow clearly and simply. But at the same time, you need to also communicate that there is this complexity and that it's not black and white, that there is gray in it. And I think the problem with the public often is that they expect that you always get this black and white answer.
Yeah.
And if you then, of course, if that is your expectation and you get the gray answer, you lose the trust. So we had like an episode on trust and science and the erosion of trust. And I think that's really a challenge.
Maybe on top, it is also important that people understand that when you have this gray zone area, which can be gray, very gray to very light gray, whatever, that you have to accept it because that's the current scientific consensus that we don't have a definite answer because we're expanding our knowledge. And that can happen within the next 2 years that we have a different opinion, or maybe within the next 10 years and we have to stay with data that we have now. And this is something that kind of differs in many people. Also, when I get in contact with many people who are not in science, they're like, well, I just want to have one answer, right? There is no one.
There is no one answer. I mean, this is a recurring element in this podcast as well, because Easy comes back time and time again and say, well, we as scientists do fail. Mm-hmm. And there's an old image of scientists, at least in Germany, I think in Europe as well, that they don't. They don't fail. They always are the truth tellers and they are godlike, you know, and you have to repair this image as well, I think.
And I don't think it's only failure. I think it's just that depending on how you design, for example, a clinical study, you will get different outcomes depending on, for example, the age of the participants or if you, what's always super challenging, right? And we'll talk probably about that in a second, is to find out the effects of different types of nutrition, of different diets on your health and well-being. So you can have, like, depending on how you design the study, you can have very different outcomes here. And this is, of course, challenging for people to understand, like, is this good for me or is that not good for me? Mm-hmm. And then there is, of course, people who pick out certain pieces of published science and blow them up like
increasingly so, yes.
Crazy. And that is very difficult, I think, for people who... I think having this balance between really trying to get down to the facts and really tell it like it is, but also give this element of uncertainty, what you just said, like we're in the zone between dark gray and light gray. And we will, I mean, during the time that I am in science or science communication, I mean, there have been so many new discoveries, right? There is, for example, when I studied, the microRNA had just been found for the first time. So who knows what will be found in the next 20 years? What will be in the dark genome, for example? So there is so much more to find. And I think we have to acknowledge, on the one hand, that. And on the other hand, we have to acknowledge that the interpretation of science can sometimes really go wrong. I mean, we have very bad examples from the past where Darwinism was misinterpreted in a horrible way, but also other pieces of science.
If I can add, the problem is also that we sometimes have really poor conducted research. And that one gets also kind of blown up or is even misleading. So there's this famous study about autism caused by vaccines, which is completely not true. In science, we have people who unfortunately are not truth seekers. They just want to have their publications out, their citations, be the next, I don't know, Nobel Prize winner. And sometimes they fake data. It is what it is. Or they analyze the data in the way that it fits their narrative. Mm-hmm. So we have kind of these black sheep. And the problem is that sometimes they're so feeded into all the misinformation people, you know, they get into that bubble and they get blown up. And then, you know, you get this extra kind of saying of all the people, oh, yeah, I knew it. You were the one that actually told us the government is, you know, spying on all these kind of things. And the health system is corrupt. And yeah, sure, there is problems, but it doesn't mean that we should distrust science. Because like me, I'm an honest scientist. I'm standing at the bench and asking myself, like, what is this protein doing inside the cell?
Shani, before you guys dig into science a little deeper, I would have a personal question, because in the introduction you said that we need science communication badly, and we agree upon that, I think. But what made you, what was your motivation of leaving the ivory tower of science and say, okay, I look into the camera, I do the science narrative for people who might have lost trust. Mm. What was the initial point for you?
The initial point started when how Daily Dose of Honest Science actually started. I had a really shitty PhD. It was horrible.
As many people do. I didn't, but many people do.
It was horrible. Okay. I talked about this on another episode of some other podcast. It was so horrible that really it left a mark on me. And I was like, okay, do I leave academia or give it a second chance?
Oh, wow. That deep.
Mm-hmm. That deep. And the first initial thought was, I need to tell the public, like, science in academia is not okay. So we need to give, like, the audience kind of the rough output here, what is happening behind the scenes. But then I realized, you can do maybe two or three episodes and then no one will hear this, because it always be negative, you know?
All right, got it.
So I thought it's much more exciting to talk about the science that is made right now with the people who are like innovators. Like, they are really at the front. They, you know, discover so many cool new things that expand our horizon in any case, any subject. And so far, I've been 1.5 years in, had so many great conversations with people, like I would have never met them. And that expanding your horizon, even as a scientist, makes me a better scientist, because I know what kind of field other people are working. And there I could even collaborate. Right. And that is kind of like the drive for me, that first of all, I want to learn what they are doing and make people excited about, oh, cool, science is really progressing, even if it's a slow progress. Sometimes it's like a snail that is very slow. But we have a progress. If you look at the last 20, 30 years, like, there's things that have been science fiction back then. And even artificial intelligence is helping us so much, even though people are saying it might be the doom for us. But, you know, if you use it in a correct way, I think it's one of the biggest things. And I want to take this veil of, let's say, skepticism and maybe even distrust and tell the people, like, it's not that what people oftentimes propagate. Right. It's actually much more beautiful. So that's like the main thing that I want to do.
To be fair, Izzy, same question to you. I mean, I know a lot more about your path, obviously, but your motivation to do podcasting, to write, to, you know, where did you start doing this?
Yeah, I was always writing. So I was writing before I became a scientist. And I also realized while I was a scientist that I'd rather talk and write about science than be at the bench. So for me, it was kind of a natural trajectory. Similar to you, I just love learning cool new stuff. So talking to people, interacting, being like diving into new fields, learning stuff. I think this is so cool. Was it for you a little bit like the experience doing the podcast, almost a bit therapeutic after having like a negative experience?
Totally. So that was really therapeutic in the sense that I became so self-confident again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The self-confidence boost that I got through this whole journey now is so immensely precious for me, that I was like, okay, I don't want to give this up. I'm trying to juggle it around, right? It's not easy having a full-time position.
No, of course not.
And doing science comm besides that, and on top, sometimes having these weird looks from outside, people be like, where are you going? I'm taking a podcast episode now. Ah, okay.
Are you a scientist or a journalist?
Exactly. Yeah, so are you actually at the bench or not?
Mm-hmm. How is it for your colleagues? How do you, I mean, you just said like you get sometimes weird looks, but in general, how do they regard this? So do they listen to the episodes and do they give you feedback? Do they want to be featured? Is it like
featured? Not. I have some colleagues who really like on LinkedIn, like the posts and so on. I'm not sure if they actively listen. This I don't know, but I think maybe they listen to the trailer, and if it's interesting, then they listen to it. What I find very interesting was one of the professors that I had, Professor Stefan Stricker. He became a diehard supporter. So Stefan, if you're hearing this, thank you so much.
That's fantastic. Wow.
So he is really like, I really like your episodes. I really like how you do it. And on LinkedIn, I see now gradually that people are liking it. And I'm quite happy now that I have like a little base of people who really like it. And also on YouTube, like the comment section is filling slowly with good people. So it's like getting a crowd together that really enjoys this kind of episodes.
Wonderful. I do hope it will eventually be contagious within the science community.
Hopefully.
Because there are not enough of you guys.
Yeah.
Of science communicators.
Yes.
Right?
It's a skill that you have to learn.
Yep.
You know, communicating your science to your peers is something completely different, right? So on conferences, on presentations in the lab meeting, that's completely different because you know with whom you're dealing. But having like science slams or these kind of science rep even does exist, I learned. There, the audience is so mixed. Some of them even don't remember what happened in school with biology. You know, like they completely forgot, and it's completely okay.
I raise my hand.
But you're getting the continuous education.
I do. And yes. I'm grateful for that.
Exactly.
Yes, of course.
So you have to deal with that. And then you have to somehow break it down to such a way that you think that the science, you're making a good service to the science, not making it watering too down, but also having the people on board and be like, okay, now they learned something and now they are not so afraid anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's the balance. And not every one of us scientists is eager to learn this skill, even though I would say everyone has to learn this. In the end, science belongs to everyone, right? So.
And I think even when you're communicating to other scientists, there's a lot you can take away from it. Because, I mean, having, I don't know, 50 data-heavy slides, even if you're into the topic, I mean, you can see it on conferences, right? I mean, the moment where people start taking out their laptops, looking at their phones, like slowly
falling asleep,
getting out
exactly.
to...
Yeah.
So, I mean, you notice, right, that if you have... If it's too many bar graphs, your brain will... Just
sometimes they also forget to tell a story.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Then the master, and I'm still trying to master it, is telling a story. Yeah. And this is sometimes really difficult.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And I think one thing that many scientists, and I completely come from this background, of course, we have learned to disappear. So you are disappearing behind your data. Your data is supposed to tell the story, and you don't exist.
Exactly.
The data shows.
Yeah.
But I think if you're communicating to other people, you need to be present. You need to be a person, even if it's just making a small joke or something on stage. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that...
It's inappropriate.
Exactly. You know? Like I think scientists feel it's inappropriate, and they're afraid that they will turn into marketing people.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which they don't. You know, but I think there is an authentic way to do it somewhere,
exactly.
A middle ground. And I think this is really the discipline that we have to master. Yeah. And there are a few scientists who are innately good at that.
Exactly.
And these are the talks where everyone's like,
exactly.
Great that you're on stage now.
Yes.
And there are many people. And I don't think that means that you have to be this kind of Rampensau, like a stage animal. But you can also do that in a more quiet way. I think there are some people who are very kind of dry, but funny.
And absolutely.
Yeah.
British understatement.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I like it. Yeah.
Totally. And maybe from the attention span that is also decreasing over time now.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that as well. I'm like,
TikTok.
Why, people? Why? So why not taking your time with all the things? And I think that's a big problem that we have to tackle. I won't change my way of how I do it. So as you see, the trailers are usually 1 minute long because I really want to give the people the opportunity to listen to the whole thing and then decide if I want to watch it or not. Right. And not by 20 seconds of clickbaity BS that is coming out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel right, especially when a scientist is presenting, because we are not presenting data in a clickbaity way, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. It's not our nature. And I think staying to that kind of true and honest way is the way forward. And I see that by communicating also with other people, that they have also said, like, we are so saturated with this over flooding of attention grabbing things mm-hmm. that it's really refreshing to see that someone takes their time. And of course, I will not go viral with all of this, but at least I'm contributing to the discussion. And one of my biggest inspiration is actually another podcast from Dr. Mike, the Checkup podcast. Mm-hmm. He's also taking like 1.5, 2 hours, even sometimes 3 hours to explain a specific topic. And of course, in the medical field, but he's taking his time. And every viewer who is there really appreciates that. So that is kind of my way of doing that with science. And, you know, science and medicine have become like these two yeah. different disciplines. Mm-hmm. And I actually want to combine them together again back. And that's like where this is leading to. That's why I'm also trying to get like medical professionals on board and we talk about it, because otherwise it will be too science and then, yeah, there's this medical stuff, but we don't touch it. It doesn't feel right, because in the ancient Greek times, medicine and science was one, you know?
And philosophy.
And philosophy, exactly. I don't know why this became so distinct, separated. I have no idea why this happened, but I think we need to collaborate on this also more and more. But we do have sometimes people who just don't want to do it because medical professionals think they know everything and scientists, vice versa.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, there are quite a few doctors who also do research, like who exactly, are at the university
exactly.
clinic.
But I think the way we scientists do research can complement them.
Yeah, of course.
So this is like the barrier that we have to overcome.
Yeah.
Because they are also doing like, they have a practice, right? Mm-hmm. They need to see patients. So how can they do research and patients at the same time? So it's like really a big task. And we scientists, if we now go into translational medicine more in collaboration with the medical doctors, I think that will be like the next huge advancement in therapies and maybe even curing diseases, you name it.
When it comes to what we did in the lab, relatively similar background. So I also, back in the days, did proteomics. I just told you on the train with the help of many of my colleagues. So if you're now listening, Stephanie, Rosa, and Tanvir, many thanks for all your help and also everyone else when I fucked up the columns again.
Confessions by Louise. I see where this is going.
No, but so we actually so far have not talked about proteomics on this podcast. No. Surprisingly, we talked a lot about more genomics-based methods, I think also because they're sometimes maybe considered a bit more advanced. But could you maybe summarize very briefly, why do we need proteomics? What's the benefit of it?
I always like to start with saying all the things that are made inside the cell, so from energy creation to packing our DNA to that the cell even can adapt, actually the workers are the proteins in our cell. Either be something that needs to be transported, anything, even an enzyme that does a little thing, it's all proteins, right? And the cool thing is they, once you understand how they work and what they do, you can actually understand why in disease state they are different than in the healthy state. And I think proteomics is like the science of proteins and analyzing proteins. And I think that is a good bridge between all the genetic and transcriptomic data that we have, so all the mRNA things, to the actual outcome. Because when you go back to the very basic of the molecular biology dogma is you have the DNA that is getting transcribed, so you have an mRNA, and then from mRNA you actually get the protein, right? Of course, not every RNA is translated to a protein, but in general, usually that's kind of the way, right? And the protein itself is super important for any function that we need inside the cell. I think proteomics can highlight, even in the clinical settings, what is different between healthy and disease, or tumor tissue and healthy tissue, whatever you want to see. But I think that's a really cool intersection. And of course, proteomics itself is divided into top-down, middle, and bottom-up. Top-down means you really take the molecule itself and introduce it to the mass spectrometer and analyze like in its entirety, which is really difficult. Yeah. Or you say, okay, I just don't want to deal with this. I just chop it off in small pieces called peptides and go from the bottom-up approach and try to map these pieces again back to the sequence and figure out what kind of proteins I have, right? Did I answer the question?
Okay, good. You did.
Perfectly.
Yes,
perfectly.
You did, of course. Yes. Yeah, no, proteomics is cool.
Any wish for you to go back to the field, go back to the lab?
No. I asked her.
You
asked
did,
her.
Really?
I did. I was like, okay, do you want to? And she said, no, not really.
No, I really enjoyed it and I had a great time. I mean, I'm one of those people who actually had fun during their mm-hmm. PhD. I mean, I think it depends very much on your supervisor colleagues.
Yeah, that's true.
And I mean, also depends on your project, but I think it mostly depends on your supervisor, how the PhD goes. So if you have a good one, then you have a
at least
better experience in
for
most
now,
cases.
For now, I'm quite happy with the three projects that I have. So the first project is out of my PhD, where I would like to characterize a protein that has been found at the centromere. The centromere biology is super crucial because if you have any problems in there, you will get aneuploidy, which means some DNA will break up and then you will lose that information. And that is kind of one hallmark of cancer. So it's really important to study it. And a great colleague of mine, Götz Hagemann, actually did a great study in analyzing what is happening at the centromere. And we figured out that there's a new protein that we would like to characterize. And right now I'm in the final stages, hopefully, to characterize that. A second project that is more drug discovery, which is I'm really excited about. My boss actually has these knockout cell lines of different methyltransferases and demethylases in human cells. And some of them are already clinical targets.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know what happens actually when they are not there anymore. And there I'm trying to characterize from that standpoint what is happening there. And the third one is my actual own kind of research that I want to do because I'm really interested in post-translational modifications. So I always say the protein's getting decorated. So people kind of...
Good picture for this.
Right? Yes. Yeah. So one decoration is adding a sugar molecule. So O-glycosylation in that sense. And that has been linked to many diseases such as diabetes, cancer, whatever, you name it, neurodegenerative diseases. And I would like to develop a more robust mass spec method that we can enrich for that, not antibody-based. I want to get a bit away from antibodies and then make it robust that every lab that, for instance, buys a kit, for instance, that can be built up from this, actually can reliably do it in their lab. Because sometimes you have the problem of translating it into other labs, right? So someone can do it in their lab, but not, I don't know, across the pond, you cannot do it for whatever reason. So that is kind of like where I am. And I'm, you know, I love the diversity. I hate when I have to work on only one thing. It's more like I want to be involved in many projects because there's so many cool things that you can do with proteomics.
Yeah, it sounds like you're having quite a range of things.
Yeah.
I mean, this glycosylation is also quite interesting because it happens to a lot of proteins, right? I think quite a large percentage of the proteins that we have get this sugar coat kind of. These sugar molecules can be very diverse. They can branch in different ways. Yeah. And it's like sugar is not sugar. We have different types of sugars. And this really adds. So we have like 20,000 genes and we have some more proteins. How many proteins do we have?
depends on which isoform you have. Yeah, exactly. Do you have isoform 1 to 5 or present? So it can be like easily double the amount.
Yeah, exactly.
Of 40.
Yeah, that's what I would have said. Yeah,
exactly.
40.
Yeah.
But then imagine like all these different decorations of the protein. So we easily end up in a range of, I don't know, a million or something, 200,000, something. Like suddenly we have many, many more variation. And this also leads back to the question, why isn't everything the same? Because almost all our cells have the same DNA. So why are they all so different? Yeah. And this lies in the magic of the proteins and their post-translational modifications, which
Absolutely.
Is a pretty cool thing to study.
Yeah.
Very
and research granted for the next 500 billion years.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is also that from these modifications, you find new ones constantly,
right.
and they interact with one another.
Exactly. So what is quite well established is phosphorylation and glycosylation, right?
Yeah.
They crosstalk with each other. But other modifications do also crosstalk, right? So how does one affect the other? What does it have to do with, I don't know, gene expression maybe? Or sometimes it's just putting one protein from one compartment to the other, right? So it's just, and we still are kind of a bit in our infancies. A really cool study just published showed macro H2A involved in the histone H2A can exist as a macro H2A variant that is able of binding ADP ribosylation. And this one has been shown, if you knock it out in mouse, that they have severe kidney dysfunction, for instance.
Okay.
So it links chromatin with metabolism and a phenotype inside these mice. And they really could nicely show, it's a science advance, just recently came out from the Helmholtz in Munich. That all shows us that like genes and metabolism and protein kind of, you know, you cannot
distinguish.
Mm. You need to take it into all into account as one unit and then figure out what's happening. And that's why I love also the way that my boss is working is chromatin proteomics. So I love like this intersection of genes and proteins and how they, you know, work with each other. And metabolism is one of the big things.
Yeah. Yeah, and also for any type of drug discovery, I think metabolism is a very big topic simply because we're also doing bad things to our metabolism all the time. Regarding to that, so I think you have a lot of episodes where you discuss, that's why I also called the episode Demystifying Science, where you talk a little bit about this science of self-improvement, let's call it, like nutrigenomics, sleep patterns, types of exercise, nutrition, etc., with your guests or sometimes also by yourself. Why are you so interested in that? Or why do you think this is like, relevant to tackle?
First of all, because it's my own interest. I find this super fascinating how nutrition actually plays a big role, diet, sleeping, in general, influencing our body itself and how we actually function, right? But then due to my presence on social media, I see how many people are actually getting that into the wrong direction in this very toxic self-improvement thing that is not really backed up by science in that sense. And
like supplements or what are you talking about?
For instance, supplements or...
We're constantly talking about the nonsense of supplements.
most of the stuff you can get, if you do it properly, of course, from your diet. So you don't need to supplement. And if you have a deficiency for whatever reason, because you have a health issue, that's completely another story.
Of course it is, yes.
Right? But I think the problem is that many times people get like, as we said, it's really important that scientists give this gray thing. But these people who sell supplements and all this, they present black and white and ignore most of the studies that actually show the opposite, what they want to, you know, present. And then it gets in this wrong direction. And I'm like, I want to give the people the opportunity to give the topic a chance to understand it properly so they don't get into the trap of these people. It's really hard because big, Andrew Huberman is one, unfortunately, Peter Attia is one. You know, they make it in such a way that it sounds sciencey, But the problem is it's not backed up. Mm-hmm. And they are not honest enough with their audience that this is actually not true what they are selling, right? And they are so big. How can you compete as a little, you know, scientist? And that's why I try to team up with different people. I'm teaming up with a German YouTuber, for instance, when he does self-experiments, that he actually gets the right context for it. Or I team up with one of my dear friends, Lorena Law. She's a medical professional in Hong Kong, where we both actually have a light on a specific topic. We did nutritional tests. How are actually they done? What is actually inside our food, for instance? How people measure that? The nutrients and so on. And then on the other one was the biological clocks. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we are not really there, but okay. So, you know, these kind of problems that occur during this black and white conversation mm-hmm. that people give, I give the people like the gray area and tell them like, yeah. This is the science, this is what we know, and that what they are doing is like not really awesomely done. This is like right. not the true value that you would get by buying the supplement. And yesterday I just saw one that I think that you will find very funny. It's 350 euros and it's a device that you can put into your toilet to pee on it and then give you like 25 biomarkers on your phone and be like, okay, this your pH is up or your, I don't know, calcium. And it triggered me yesterday so much that I needed to write a comment below it, because usually I watch this person kind of often, and be like, if you next time need someone who really gives you like a perspective, please call me or write me an email. Like,
because stop the BS.
Mm. Yeah, no, he was not propagating. He's more like testing it out. Like he's right, a high-tech gadget tester, you know, like Alexi Bexi, his name is in German. And there were a few comments down. They were saying, well, I would have appreciated if a doctor would have been there. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I'm like, okay, at least a scientist can tell you, like, this is BS or not and whatever. So, yeah, that is the main reason why I think it's important to tell the people about this.
Mm-hmm. Supplements, yeah. I mean, in the best case, most of them just don't work. So they just cost money. In the worst case, they are not very great for your liver and kidney, depending on what else and how many of those you take, I would say that's. Yeah. But then for these tracking metrics, I mean, there are a lot of people, right, who do glucose monitoring, any other type of. And also this, I found it really interesting in the sleep episode that you did that. I mean, for some people, this can actually switch to the other side, that if you track your sleep obsessively, that you cannot sleep anymore. I think for me, that would happen. I'm generally.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because if you have periods where you sleep badly, you're already anxious. And then if your phone constantly tells you you should be anxious because you're not sleeping, I don't know if this is
that's
very helpful.
That's why I love the episode, because Ellie was telling that they are actually developing an app that really helps people based on real science, right? They really try to back it up with science, with clinical trials, and really gives like an improvement protocol, what you can do to get it better. Yeah. Because right now, and as he said, the problem is with these apps, they don't really provide value in what can I do different. They just say, you slept bad. And that's, even though sometimes I find this very interesting, people say, I feel very refreshed. Yeah. I feel actually fine. And then they look at the phone and be like,
should I be worried now?
You know?
You're not fine, actually.
And
that's
then,
what the data shows.
Exactly,
oh, my God.
Exactly. And then I think that creates like an anxiety that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
You know?
And even a disconnect, I think, from your own body, because I think many things are also, in general, I would say modern life is creating a bit of a disconnect because we are having many things that are maybe not so healthy, like very high productivity, look at screens a lot, maybe don't do the things that we should naturally do. I mean, but I also feel that these reliance on tracking and also reliance on external, I don't know, things like vitamin can really mess up your feeling for what would be the right thing, for example, to eat, or when are you tired or something, because our bodies for many centuries have told us kind of. And I mean, this is not to say we're biological beings, so we're far from perfect, right? We're like the one possible version of many, many possible versions. But I think still there is some I mean, that sounds a little bit like grandmotherish, but some sense in connecting with yourself in a way to listen a little bit to yourself, what your body is really telling you, more than listening to your smart toilet. Exactly. And I mean, people are also like, so often I hear of all these things trying to fix things that are not broken. And yeah, then, and by that breaking things.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Mm.
Like getting some kind of peptide injections that are untested. I mean, and one real big problem with all these supplement stories is that they are not drugs, so they don't need to undergo testing. So even if what's on paper in it is not harmful, what's in it in reality might be actually quite different from...
Sometimes it's not even that in there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Quick elephants in the room. Elephant number one, when are you going to quit science? Because you said that you are not an influencer yet. You are, you didn't go viral yet. And I think we clearly worked out that we need science communications big time in our age and time. So when are you going to quit?
Never.
All right. Elephant in the room number two, when are we going to cure the mess we're in right now in a really holistic societal sense that we are poisoned by the 10-second snippets we're surrounded by and there's no way to put science into 10 seconds?
No, that's true.
Of course it's not. And we're fortunate enough to be on podcasts where this is the only long format that people are willing to kind of digest and take in. So we're at the right place. But do you see any movement, any from your feedback you're getting that people at some point will, I phrase it like I want to phrase it, come to their senses again?
I think the problem is that we have right now is this, a lot of people are creating these shorts and not letting science come into place. But I think depending on which science communicator or scientist you look at, many of them actually really want to give value to the topic. And that's why they take a bit more time to make 2, 3, even 4 minutes of science. But of course, it's not enough for a whole topic, right? So first of all, it was a reel that I saw on the CEO of Instagram. He was like, yeah, if you want to be seen on the reel, then you need a hook, you need this, you need that. And then I was brave enough to write under his comment section. I'm like, well, how about increasing the attention span and not having clickbaity titles and clickbaity hooks that actually mislead people? And funny enough, one of the people really resonated with that and liked it and said, I agree with you 100%. So I got one person at least.
Well, that's the beginning, isn't
right?
It?
One at a time.
And I think with my content, it's called Daily Dose of Honest Science. But if you look at it, it's not daily in that sense. But it will gradually become daily because I will create content that at some point you can fill up a whole year with it.
Beautiful.
You know, and that is the main purpose that I have. And I think it's going into the direction, but it needs us who really give like this perspective and tell the people like you need to take your time. It's not like a show in ProSieben or something that you have just silly things coming up. It's serious business. And if you really want to have the best informed decision also for your health sometimes, you need to take your time and you need to also appreciate. This is a lot of work what we are doing, right? You are editing, taking care of everything here. And behind the scenes, people mostly don't get it, right? But there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes and it's your own money, right, that you're putting in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And me as well. I'm doing this in my spare time
to
provide the most biggest value. Yeah. And I think if people understand this, then they start to appreciate it.
And I think that we sometimes underestimate the intelligence of people. I think that in general society breaks everything down to this short attention span and to like very simple messages. And I think most people are much smarter than that and much more capable of thinking through ideas.
It also helps your brain in general, right? So if you think about a complex issue, you have to think about it even more, and actually that gives you a satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely, yeah.
I think that is something that people have to, let's say, relearn, because they get everything in bite sizes, mm-hmm. which is, in my opinion, not okay. And I think it's also important to give the people the opportunity to also juggle around with complex terms. Mm-hmm. You try to explain it, but some terms in science, you cannot just replace it by everyday term or something. Yeah. It's just not possible.
Fair enough, yes.
And I would say that this is super important to give the people the opportunity to learn this term and use it, right? Mm-hmm. I think what an ideal public would be is appreciating the science and understanding if a scientist is standing in front of you and juggles around with some of the terms, and you'll be like, ha, I know what you're talking about.
And you know? I mean, we achieved that to an extent during corona pandemic. I mean, people suddenly understood things and terms that they didn't understand before.
Exactly.
And I think this could be much more possible also for other parts of science communication. And I would say also communication of the medical profession to their patients, who often have a translation gap in what disease do I have and what does that actually mean.
Exactly.
Izzy, talking about attention span, I think we used a lot of time of our listeners and viewers. This was the BioRevolution podcast. Many thanks for listening. I hope you will subscribe to our podcast and our guest podcast, of course. Everything related to this will be in our liner notes, and you can look up everything at sciencetales.com. We are looking forward to your feedback. Many, many thanks for listening. Many thanks that you've been here.
Thank you for the invitation.